While digesting Reader's Digest in the back of the dirty bookstore, a plastic flag with gum on the back fell out on the floor. Well, I picked it up and I ran outside, slapped it on my window shield. And if I could see old Betsy Ross, I'd tell her how good I feel. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. Morning, and the cashier said to me, if you join the Christmas club, we'll give you 10 of them flags for free. Well, I didn't mess around a bit, I took him up on what he said, and I stuck them stickers all over my car and one on my wife's forehead. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore.
Been a busy week for me. At least I get to do this show from my own apartment rather than McDonald's. Not that I really minded it, except for background noise. It was a bit of an adventure. You know, we'd stopped at four other McDonald's and several other potential Wi-Fi spots before we finally found one where Wi-Fi worked and there was a power plug. My cousin Peter Mock, who we interviewed on this show last year, was getting pretty nervous that we wouldn't manage to get it done, but well, I had faith that it would happen, and it did. Kind of. Anyway, this week, I came to really appreciate my family. For the first time in 20 or 30 years that so many in my generation have been in one place. The memorial for my mom was wonderful. I truly feel as though this reunion with my cousins was her final gift to me. This past Tuesday, three of us, Peter, my wife Lorraine, and I, scattered her ashes, or most of them, at Hillsborough Inlet. They could go out into the Atlantic. In 1984, when my dad died, we scattered his ashes in the ocean a mile or two out from that same inlet, so it was just the right place. Meanwhile, the world's gone on. The world has changed. A national leader who had the guts to stand up in the UN after George W. Bush and tell the gathering that the podium smelled like brimstone, well, Hugo Chavez is dead. He was universally hated in Washington, D.C. You know, that alone might be enough to might be enough reason to like him, but there were a lot of other reasons. Consider this from Associated Press business reporter Pamela Sampson. Chavez invested Venezuela's oil wealth into social programs, including state-run food markets, cash benefits for poor families, free health clinics, and education programs. But those gains were meager compared with the spectacular construction projects that oil riches spurred in glittering Middle Eastern cities, including the world's tallest building in Dubai, plans for branches of the Louvre and Guggenheim Museums in Abu Dhabi. Well, as Jim Narekis said in an article on Information Clearinghouse, that's right. Chavez squandered his nation's oil money on health care, education, and nutrition when he could have been building the world's tallest building or his own branch of the Louvre. What kind of monster has priorities like that? Yeah. What kind of monster indeed? Chavez was not afraid of the USA. He kept right on doing what he believed. And the poor in Venezuela are much better off as a result. The man had courage. He made a difference in his world. Here on the New American Dream Radio Show, we respect people who make a difference. Here on the New American Dream Radio Show, we want to make a difference. And we want to inspire you to make a difference, too. What can you do? Well, I'm glad you asked. You can start by making little changes that affect those around you. Help someone get a meal or a roof over their head. Work to change a local law that discriminates against homeless. Volunteer at a shelter. Go to a rally. You can even talk on a radio show. If enough of us do these things, we'll be noticed by others who aren't quite ready to make a move. But then those people will join in. More and more people start to help each other instead of hurting each other. And the movement will grow. Well, let's start right now, tonight. Do something nice for someone tonight before you go to bed. Tell them you did it. Because helping people is part of your new American dream. Tell them the only payment you want is for them to do something nice for somebody else. This is how we can create a movement, the New American Dream Movement. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show. And now I'm proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek. An American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome special guests John Friend and Sherwood Ross. John hasn't been with us before. He'll be joining us every month as a columnist. Sherwood Ross has been with us many, many times. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, San Diego, Coral Gables, and wherever you are. Please consider the white rose and whether it has any relation to our current situation in 2013 in the United States of America. We have several people serving prison sentences for protesting the killing by drones done by our Nobel Peace Prize winning president. We have the case of the Transform Now plowshares. They're facing a May 7th trial to include sabotage charges. They had a February 7th motions hearing. For more on the Transform Now plowshares, go to just Google Transform Now plowshares. It's transformnowplowshares.wordpress.com. And also Bradley Manning, who faces life imprisonment for doing what a real American should do while his commander-in-chief, a liar and murderer, gets the Nobel Peace Prize. And also Hugo Chavez, who was likely murdered because he resisted the American Empire. Also consider ESPN. Dennis Rodman in North Korea. On ESPN this past week, the host was letting this one guy talk about Dennis Rodman in North Korea. And the guy starts talking about American complicity in the North Korean situation, just such as how are they supposed to feel with American military might staring down their throats, and about how we also execute people and about Guantanamo, things that are never, ever supposed to be mentioned on American television. And the host has about 10 people shouting in his earphones about shut him up, and that's what he does. And it's in those golden moments one experiences in person that makes one want to pinch oneself to realize it's not a dream. So with all that in mind and pinching ourselves all the while on the arms and in the forehead, let us consider again the white rose and whether it has any relation to our current situation in 2013 in the United States of America. 70 years ago, on February 23, 1943, three courageous German college students at the University of Munich were beheaded by the Gestapo after being arrested 5 days earlier and convicted of treason earlier in the day. The group included 22-year-old medical student Christoph Probst, 24-year-old Hans Scholl, also a medical student, and Hans's 21-year-old sister Sophie. They were part of a small group of university students whose code name was the White Rose. As were many other alert Germans, the White Rose was fully aware of the atrocities that were being committed against certain non-Aryan minorities. They had seen clearly the loss of liberty, the shredding of human rights, and the disturbing reality that the war was probably already lost. By the summer of 1942, these savvy dissenters, who knew that resisting Hitler in any form was a capital crime, were fully aware of the existence of Nazi concentration camps and that hundreds of thousands of Jews had already been murdered in them. These altruistic young Germans were also alarmed at the fear and apathy that they witnessed in adults all around them. They were troubled by the fact that no active resistance movements were being organized by anyone that they knew. The White Rose students, of which there were dozens scattered around Germany, knew that Hitler's aggressive war-making, torture, and state-sponsored terrorism were making Germany the most hated nation in the world. Being real patriots who loved their homeland enough to have an argument with it, they felt that they had to do something to stop Hitler. So in late 1942, the White Rose started composing and distributing amazingly insightful, well-written leaflets warning their fellow Germans about the criminal regime that most Germans seemed to be tolerating without objection. These altruistic students were wise enough to realize that they needed to use nonviolent resistance tactics in their efforts. They had witnessed the brutality of the Homeland Security agencies, the secret police, and the see something, say something policies that encourage folks to snitch on their neighbors. These students knew that the liberal printing presses had already been smashed by white right-wing fascist thugs. Even nonviolent resistance to tyranny was a capital crime in Nazi Germany. The major treasonous crime that the White Rose members were accused and convicted of was circulating a series of six subversive leaflets whose only purpose was to awaken fellow Germans to the atrocities that were being perpetrated by Hitler's henchmen to try to motivate them to rise up in resistance. Of course, the major crime they may have been guilty of was embarrassing this Gestapo and humiliating the Nazis by successfully evading detection and capture for so many months. The Nazis thought that the influence of the White Rose ended with their arrests, trial, and beheadings. The trial, so well portrayed in the powerful movie Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, was orchestrated by the notorious Roland Freisler, the shrieking Nazi judge, would have been ordered by Hitler to organize the infamous People's Court show trials that the Nazis then used for propaganda purposes and to instill fear in the people. Little did the Nazis realize that the executions of this heroic group, rather than eliminating them from the pages of history, actually made martyrs of them so that their spirits live on, continuing to inspire modern nonviolent resistance movements to this very day. These following are excerpts from the third leaflet of the White Rose, February 1943. But our present state is the dictatorship of evil. Oh, we've known that for a long time. I hear you object, and it isn't necessary to bring that to our attention again. But I ask you, if you know that, why do you not bestir yourselves? Why do you allow these men who are empowered to rob you step by step, openly and in secret, of one domain of your rights after another until one day nothing at all will be left but a mechanized state system presided over by criminals and drunks? Is your spirit already so crushed by abuse that you forget it is your right, or rather your moral duty, to eliminate this system? Many, perhaps most of the readers of these leaflets do not see clearly how they can practice an effective opposition. We have no great number of choices. The only one available is passive but active resistance. At all points, we must oppose fascism wherever it is open to attack. We must soon bring this monster of a state to an end. A victory of fascist Germany in this war would have immeasurable, frightful consequences. The defeat of the Nazis must unconditionally be the first order of business. Sabotage in armament plants and war industries, sabotage at all gatherings, rallies, public ceremonies, and organizations of the National Socialist Party, obstruction of the smooth functioning of the war machine, a machine for war that goes on solely to shore up and perpetuate the Nazi Party and its dictatorship, sabotage in all publications, all newspapers that are in the pay of the fascist government and that defend its ideology. The presses run continuously to manufacture any desired amount of paper currency. Try to convince all your acquaintances, including those in the lower social classes, of the senselessness of continuing of the hopelessness of this war, of our spiritual and economic enslavement at the hands of the National Socialists, of the destruction of all moral and religious values, and urge them to passive resistance. Aristotle said it is part of the nature of tyranny that everywhere the subjects will be spied upon, and so it is part of these tyrannical measures to keep the subjects poor in order to pay the guards and soldiers, and so that they will be occupied with earning their livelihood and will have neither leisure nor opportunity to engage in conspiratorial acts. Please duplicate and distribute. This essay on the White Rose was written by Gary G. Coles of Duluth and was published recently in the Duluth Reader.
At the basketball game on Friday, everyone went outside the double glass doors to have a smoke at halftime. The weathermen, Steve and Sally Storm. Sandy Ben Snore, big time journalism whore. Buzz the Space Dog. War Priest, Father Jack Duffy. Carl and Buster, the last of the paper boys. They were all out there enjoying the mild late winter night air. We got to start running more zones, said Buzz. How's the coffee? Asked Ben Snore. You ready for March Madness? Asked Father Jack. Where are you guys going for spring break this year? Carl asked the Storms. Did you see that supposed phony medical examiner? Said Fred the Farmer as he held the door for Tina Thompson, Taco Bell trainee. I know, right? Said Amelia Earhart, proprietor of Mount Liberty Ink Tattoo Shop, coming out the other glass door. Talk quickly came around to Sandy Hook for a moment, with Fred and Amelia firing at each other back and forth. It was a total psyop. Nobody was killed. It was a drill. They were all actors. Same thing with Aurora in Tucson, 9/11. They're just learning how to use television so well. Rather impressive to watch, actually. And someone asked about the weather, whether it would rain or snow next week. The Bahamas, Steve and Sally Storm said together, smiling, clicking their styrofoam coffee cups together. Troy, the town cop, pulled up in the cruiser on the curb, left it running, and walked up to ask Father Jack for a light. Good snow, Troy said. Everyone looked at the dark sky for a moment. They all flicked their butts into the grass or crushed them on the cement and then took their time heading back inside. Carl and Buster, the last of the paper boys, stayed out with Amelia Earhart of Mount Liberty Inc. to have one more smoke. Pretty good game, said Carl and Buster nodded. That one guy's a great shot. Yeah, said Amelia Earhart, blowing the smoke straight up into the air, looking for the writing in the sky. Not seeing it, she sent out her mental messages, her psychic ... Morse code. Am here, awaiting rescue. Abduct me.
Dateline Vatican City, headlines from the Vatican. Pope takes break in Cancun to help him cope. Won't take dope or grope. Promises not to mope. Walking the old tightrope, proverbial slippery slope, can't elope. Will he be back? Nope, we hope. There is some word that he might be talking to the CIA about taking an undercover job investigating black market sales of illicit golden robes, big-ass rings, velvet shoes, and pointed hats. Last Thursday, the big kahuna, Pontiff Benedict XVI, greeted well-wishers from the balcony in his window, and spotted next to him with a hand on the Pope's shoulder was what many observers thought to be the ghost of George Carlin, claimed supported by the retiring Pope's last words. When it comes to bullshit, big-time major league bullshit, you have to stand in awe of the all-time champion of false promises and exaggerated claims, religion. No contest, religion. Religion easily has the greatest bullshit story ever told. Think about it. Religion has actually convinced people that there is an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do, every minute of every day. And the invisible man has a special list of 10 things he does not want you to do. If you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish, where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of the time. But he loves you. He loves you, and he needs money. He always needs money. He's all-powerful, all-perfect, all-knowing, and all-wise. Somehow, just can't handle money. Religion takes in billions of dollars. They pay no taxes, and they always need a little more. Now, you talk about a good bullshit story. Holy shit. Dateline, Vatican City. Headlines from the Vatican, sponsored by Pope on a Rope Soap. And in other news, Dateline, Yakima, Washington, 6 underground tanks that hold a brew of radioactive and toxic waste at the nation's most contaminated nuclear site are leaking, federal and state officials said Friday. Now here's Bobby with the March Madness Sports, Big Hamburger, Big Fancy Kitchen, and Numerology Report. Tonight's March Madness, Big Hamburger, Fancy New Kitchen, and Numerology Report is sponsored by the good folks at Teleprompter Corp. Hey, guess who radiates the message to President Obama, who radiates the message to the American people? Teleprompter Corp, of course. Osama bin Laden buried at sea, Sandy Hook, drones fight for freedom, bail out the bankers, the poor going to get a $1.75 raise, going to be able to eat at Wendy's now. Batman needs Joker like the U.S. needs Al-Qaeda. If it weren't real, it would have to be invented. I know, right? We're Teleprompter Corp. We bring the lies into your lives by putting the words into his mouth. Our first guest is John Friend. I don't know if John will be calling in. It might be a few minutes, but I'll go through the introduction here, Chuck. And I told John 5 till, so from my clock we got about 3 minutes yet, but I'll go through this, and then I can talk a little bit about John until he comes on. John Friend is a blogger from San Diego. I just found out in talking with him by email that he was originally from Omaha and moved out to San Diego a few years ago. So I had to tell him I was from Norfolk, a little bit to the north. He will be joining us as a monthly columnist. His website is johnfriend.net. He holds a Bachelor of Arts degree, and he's just about finished up with a master's in public administration. He hosts a weekly radio program Monday evenings called The Realist Report with John Friend on the Truth Militia Radio Network. And I visited John's website, and he just has a lot of interesting stuff on there. I first heard about him in listening to a radio show he was doing with Jim Fetzer, and they were talking about this Sandy Hook, shooting or event or whatever you would like to call it. They were also talking about 9/11. He also has interesting ideas about the Holocaust, and I guess that's a subject I haven't delved into much. I've been hearing more talk about it, whether the Holocaust actually happened as it did, and I think it's open for discussion. It has to be. If the goal of the New American Dream radio show is that anything is up for discussion. It doesn't mean we have to agree with that, but there cannot be anything that we are not allowed to discuss. We can be wrong. We can be idiots. We can be whatever we are. You know, we just are. But we have to be allowed to ask every question that comes to our mind. And I think about the moon landings. I think about 9/11. I think about all these different issues that we seem to be not able to discuss. You know, if you watch enough or any, if you watch one night of nightly news or read one newspaper or listen to one Clear Channel radio program, you know that some things just won't be discussed. And that's what I guess what I was talking about in my opening about Nazi Germany. was that it seems to me that we already live in a fascist country. You know, it's not, there's just some things we cannot discuss that won't be discussed. And that's not the way it is with the democracy, I don't think. I think that everything should be on the table to be discussed, and that's how we learn, that's how we come to grow. You know, I think the world would be changed almost overnight if somebody like Kevin Barrett or Jim Fetzer were allowed to be on the nightly news. Say we had the nightly news with Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett rather than Brian Williams. Well, of course, the world would be changed overnight. And it's because there would be certain things that could be talked about that cannot be talked about now. I mean, John Stewart, you know, if he would talk about certain things such as 9/11, which he seems to be afraid to do. And John Friend is here now. John is going to be joining us as a monthly columnist, and we're just glad to have him here. He joins us tonight from San Diego. Hello, John. It's nice to talk to you, and please take it away.
Mike and Chuck, thank you so much for inviting me on to be a somewhat regular guest host. And sorry for the technical issues. I was trying to call you guys, but for some reason it wouldn't go through. So I had to log on and use Skype. But hopefully I'm sounding loud and clear. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, it's real good, John. I can hear you real good.
Okay, excellent. Well, I thought I'd just maybe do a little bit of introduction and then maybe get into a couple of the topics that I discuss quite a bit on my radio show and my website. So to start off, I'm not sure if you kind of gave me an introduction already and you know, listed off my website and my radio show and all that. So maybe I can just do that real quick.
Go for it, John.
Okay, sounds good. My website, if you go to john-friend.net, you can find – it's basically my blog. I actually just purchased that domain name, and what I did was I took my free Blogspot account, and I just transferred it to that domain name, and I'll be using that going forward. So be sure to check that out, John, John-friend, FRIEND.net. And I also host my own radio program, which normally airs Monday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and it's called The Realist Report with John Friend, and it's on the Truth Militia Radio Network, which is actually also on Blog Talk Radio. So if anybody's interested in more information about that, I'd suggest that they go to my website. You can always find the links to download my radio shows and find links to all my past radio shows. Or you can go to truthmilitia.com, where that's basically our network page, where you can find information about past and upcoming shows. Not only my show, but other shows that we have on the network. We got a really good group of guys over there. Much like you guys, you know, we're trying to formulate solutions, and you know, we're trying to talk about some of the most important issues and subjects that you certainly won't hear in the controlled mainstream media. That's for sure. I'm sure you guys both know that. So anyways, just a little bit about myself. I'm actually from Omaha, Nebraska, and apparently I just was exchanging emails with Mike earlier today. Apparently he's from Nebraska as well, which is pretty cool. So let me just go ahead and say, go Big Red, go Huskers. You know, I was born in 1986, so I kind of grew up in the 90s. And all you football fans out there know that Nebraska was absolutely dominating in the 1990s. We went to the national championship a number of times, and we actually won it a couple times. So it was a good time to be born and raised in Nebraska for a football fan like myself. So anyways, born and raised in Omaha, went to high school in Omaha, Omaha Central High School. Go ahead and do a Google search for it. It's a really cool high school, one of the biggest ones in Nebraska. And I actually got a really good education considering it was a public school. And most public schools in America today are kind of lacking in the academic side, shall we say, and facing a number of other problems, including finance problems and whatnot. So it was a good school. I got a pretty good education. I was involved in football and baseball and whatnot. And then I went to school at the University of Nebraska, and I graduated in December of 2008. And I got a degree in international studies. I got to study abroad a couple times. I went over to Europe to study in Italy in 2006, in the summer of 2006, And, I was really lucky. I was really blessed, actually. I show up over in Italy to study abroad, and next thing I realize, Italy is in the World Cup Championship against France, and Italy actually won the World Cup when I was studying there, so it was really cool. I was in this little small town right on the Adriatic Sea, and there was probably myself and about 40 other students from around Europe. There was one or two other Americans, but it was mostly Europeans and Australians. So it was really just a great time. We had a lot of fun. We learned a lot. So that was great. And then in 2008, I had the opportunity to go down to Lima, Peru, and I did a two-week course in Lima where we were basically studying the effects of globalization and, this neoliberalism that we're told is supposed to lift all boats and get everybody out of poverty, when in fact it does basically the opposite and keeps everybody as slaves. But maybe I can get into that later on down the line here. So I went down to Peru. I ended up going to Machu Picchu and took a hike and visited that monument. It was absolutely amazing. It was definitely one of the coolest things I've ever done in my life, and I had a blast doing it. I came back and I graduated the very next semester. And when I was in college, I was working for a nonprofit organization. Basically sort of in a teaching role. I wasn't called a teacher, wasn't, sanctioned by the state or anything like that, but I was working with kids and having a good time, and I ended up moving to San Diego, California, where I was doing the same thing for a program with the YMCA, and I did that for a year, and I ended up staying in San Diego, so I've been here ever since. It's been about 3 years, and I've always been really interested in history and politics and philosophy. And kind of alternative politics, because when I was in college, once you start, really taking a look at what was going on, and I mean, keep in mind, this was shortly after the war in Iraq started, which happened when I was in high school. Actually, 9/11, a subject I'm going to talk about here for a minute. 9/11 actually happened when I was a sophomore in high school. And, of course, being a young kid, you don't really know what to think. You're kind of listening to the media and quote-unquote authority figures to kind of tell you what to think and how to interpret the events. So I didn't really know what to make of it. Then we started all these wars, first Afghanistan, then Iraq, and now, our troops are involved in a number of different conflicts all around the world, all of which are totally illegal, immoral, counterproductive, totally against the interests of America and really the entire world for that matter. So I was really jaded, especially finding out that there were no weapons of mass destruction and basically the entire war in Iraq was based on lies. So I was investigating this. I was also investigating and reading about how American troops and members of the CIA and other third parties that the American government or the American military would contract were actually engaged in torture techniques, and they were engaged in murder and, the use of drones to basically go over and bomb and terrorize innocent civilians all around the world who pose no threat to myself, my family, my nation, my country, my community, absolutely nobody. So, I mean, I was just totally taken aback by this and really kind of waking up to, oh, wow, this is what America's all about. This is not what I was taught when I was in school. So, I stayed interested in politics and history, and I was involved in a couple different activist-type groups in Nebraska. And then when I moved to San Diego after I graduated college, I was kind of free to explore some of my own interests and pursue some of my own interests rather than reading all the stuff that you get from your professors in college. So I moved out here to San Diego, and I actually ran into the San Diegans for 9/11 Truth group. And they actually have a really dedicated and experienced group of activists. So I ran into this group pretty much the first week I was in San Diego because I was sort of looking for a new political activist group that I can get involved with. And like I said, I ran into this group and I started attending some of their meetings. And I didn't really look critically at 9/11 prior to this. I had heard some of the conspiracy, quote unquote, conspiracy theories. And, I'd seen some of the – I actually saw Loose Change, I believe it was, back when I was – I had to have been a sophomore or junior in college. And I didn't really know what to think of it. I thought it was interesting, and I remember my first thought was, you know, this, if this is right, if this, you know, if this documentary is presenting some sort of truth here, what I think is that 9/11 was done by some sort of criminal faction that was in control of the government. So it wasn't necessarily the government, quote unquote, that was behind 9/11. I just remember thinking that whoever controls the government, whatever the, you know, whatever group of criminals actually control the government, they were behind it. And I didn't, you know, obviously I didn't pursue this subject too much more after that until I moved to San Diego, and then I really got into it. I came to San Diego and we watched the San Diegans for 9/11 Truth Group. They always screen a film once a week, usually some sort of 9/11 documentary or some sort of documentary relating to the fraudulent global war on terror or the use of drones and some of these illegal, immoral policies the United States government has been prosecuting in our name since 9/11 and really actually before 9/11. But they're just out in the open, you know, proudly proclaiming that they're breaking the law and they don't care what American citizens say anymore. In fact, you may be targeted for for speaking out against the government nowadays. I started researching 9/11 and it was really just a fascinating subject for me. I mean, it totally blew the lid off the mainstream version of American history, even more so than I had already sort of learned about. I mean, obviously I knew that a lot of the stuff we were learning in college when I was at school was basically propaganda, and kind of a distortion of what was really going on. So once I really woke up to 9/11 and said, oh, wow, this was a complete inside job. There's no way that these Muslim, quote unquote, Muslim terrorists were involved in this. They were basically set up and framed. So I just was totally floored by this. Obviously, I think anybody that wakes up to what's really going on, and they wake up to 9/11, for instance, it can be an emotional process. It can't, you can feel depressed and really kind of just, bent out of shape for a while. And I certainly was. I mean, it was a very tough thing to come to grips with. But at the same time, I think when you wake up to the realization that 9/11 was in fact an inside job, not only an inside job, 9/11 was done by the state of Israel. And there is absolutely no doubt about this after all the research I've done and all the other research you can find online. And I'd like to actually get into that in just a minute. But basically, I was just spending pretty much all my free time researching 9/11 and trying to relearn everything that I had just been brainwashed in when I was in college. So, I came to
John.
Yeah.
John, this is Mike. I just need to tell you we have about 3 minutes.
Oh, okay. I took a little bit longer than I thought.
No, it's okay. I just want to let you know about three minutes and that'll have to be it.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll just wrap this up quick. And then maybe next week or next time I'm on the show, I'll spend a little bit more time on 9/11 and just explain in more detail my thoughts and why I say that Israel was behind 9/11. So just to wrap up here, guys, sorry about that, Mike, I didn't realize it was this went so quick. But anyways, my blog that I started after I kind of learned about 9/11, I started a blog and I started writing about this stuff and posting information, posting videos. And that's kind of what led me to get into radio and some of the stuff I'm doing today. So my website is focused primarily on 9/11 and the lies concerning World War II, Adolf Hitler, and the alleged Jewish Holocaust that were propagandized into believing. So those are pretty much the two subjects that I spend the majority of my time covering. In my radio show, again, I'm interviewing who I think to be some of the most intelligent and insightful individuals that I can find anyways. So, check out my radio show. Check out my website. It's john-friend.net. And my radio show is on Mondays at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And every once in a while, I do a special broadcast, maybe on like a Friday or a Thursday. It just sort of depends. But, if you follow my website, you should be able to find all the updates. And again, I just want to thank Chuck and Mike for bringing me on. Next time I'm on, maybe I'll spend a little bit more time explaining 9/11 and some of the conclusions I've come to. But for now, I just want to thank those guys. And I look forward to next time.
John, thank you very much. And I just want to say it's nice to meet you. And we look forward to talking to you every month. And I guess that's it. Have a good night.
Excellent. Now, sorry, is this Mike, by the way?
Pardon? Yeah, this is Mike.
Oh, okay. So much. I appreciate it. No big red. I'll leave you guys.
Okay. See you later.
Those crazy CIA lone nut shooters. The Waco kids. Burned alive. 9/11. What really happened? Round up at the OKC Marat Corral. Operation Northwoods. Gulf of Tonkin. Buried at sea. MLK, RFK, JFK. Wellstone. Killed by Cheney Hit Squad. It's the new Hollywood lineup for the coming year because, you know what? We don't need the military or CIA to okay every film we make. We're actors, paid, big time, famous, celebrity, comfortable. Well, you know. No room. Oh, cutting room floor, you know. Well, you're going to dig the new Tom Hanks film. Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone. Already nominated for Best Picture, Nobel Peace Prize, and Oprah's List. Get ready for Top Gun 4 this summer, Zero Dark 32, Rambo 9, Red Dawn again. We're American actors.
Troy, the town cop, was sitting in the Hardee's parking lot looking for speeders when he got a call to go check out some guys with assault rifles over by the elementary school. Some guys in blaze orange and camo, boots, plaid ear flap caps, gloves, sitting in the soccer net. They say they're duck hunting. But hunting season isn't until we got every right. Yeah, I know. Second Amendment. Yeah, I know. But the elementary school? Why not on the river? It's the principal, man. Don't you see? Well, I got to have your guns, and you can't sit here. It's school property. Yeah, okay. Didn't think you'd be like this, Troy. Thought we were in this together. So Troy, the town cop, takes the guy's guns and waits in the squad until he sees them roar off in the blaze orange F-150. Now he's got all these guns in the back seat, and he can't go have coffee at McDonald's because now everyone's pissed at him. So what's he going to do? He's got to live here for about 100 years yet with these guys. Well, Troy rolled down the window, smoked a cigarette, got out of the cruiser, opened the back door, and then drove off again slow, speeding up and swerving every now and again, dropping a shotgun or an assault rifle into the street, one about every block. And in about a week, all the guns got back into the hands of the rightful owners, and Troy was back enjoying his coffee breaks at McDonald's, not outside in the parking lot, but right inside in the booths with all the guys. Troy looked down at his coffee cup that he was gripping tight with both hands, leaving indentations in the styrofoam. The only way they're getting this cup, he thought to himself, would be to rip it from my cold, dead fingers. He smiled and looked up to laugh at a joke he'd heard before.
Our second guest tonight is our regular columnist, Sherwood Ross. And he hasn't called in just yet, so I think I'm going to call him, if you'll bear with me just a moment.
If folks read the newsletter that I send out, or if they, even if they don't, you know, probably know that Sherwood Ross is a veteran newspaper reporter. I don't know his whole story, but he did work in Chicago, started out there. I think he graduated from the University of Miami back in the day, as they say. And he was also instrumental in the civil rights movement. He wrote about it and covered it and walked along. And he right now, Sherwood is published on many, many websites around the web. If you go and you go, he's also on. I see him often on Veterans Today, and many other places. And he's just very prolific and very interesting and very interested in what is going on, and we just feel lucky to have him on the radio show. I think he's been on every month for a long time. And he speaks to us from Coral Gables, which I think is not too far from Chuck in Fort Lauderdale.
That's correct.
Hello,
Sherwood. Welcome to the radio show.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Is this Chuck?
Yes, it is.
Chuck, I got to tell you that I feel honored to be on your radio program, given all that you have done and all the time you have served in protest of the war machine in this country. I want to congratulate you for that.
I appreciate that, Sherwood.
Anyway, I thought I would talk about prisons and read a poem about prisons that I wrote. And I remember the first time I toured a prison was the New Jersey prison at Rahway. And I was struck at how much it resembled a school. You know, based on all those James Cagney movies I grew up with, you know, I thought of prisoners as desperate men who had to be taken everywhere under armed guard. And if they only could, they'd grab the warden and demand their release in return for his freedom. But Rahway showed me the reality. When I met the warden, he said, "Come on, I'll show you around." And soon the two of us, we were totally unarmed, unescorted, are walking through the corridors of the Rahway prison, huge institution, as though we were on a busy street in downtown Newark. It was like changing of classes time back in high school. It seemed that every inmate had a book and that the prison was all about learning. I mean, these guys were students. That's what they were. You know, they may have been criminals in another life, but now they were students. And another thing I noticed is that the Rahway population was overwhelmingly black. And I couldn't help but think back to all the angry protests from black parents demanding a good education for their children. Why? Because they knew that if their kids didn't get it, they would wind up in places like Rahway. And the racial complexion, which was overwhelmingly Afro, seemed to prove that they were right. The next thing I noticed about Rahway is that the prisoners weren't violent, like in the Cagney movies. Now and then one would come right up to the warden and ask for some favor or other, and the warden might say, "I can't do that for you because you did such and such last month, and you know it." And the prisoner would accept the warden's decision and walk off. Without assaulting him. The prisoners seemed bound by a code of fair play. If they had done something criminal to get in prison in the first place, that was before. Now they knew enough to abide by the law. And that showed me there had to be some kind of major change in their life, and that even hardened men could be changed. By the end of the afternoon on that tour, I was coming to see prisoners as human beings, not vicious Hollywood stereotypes. And I was also coming to see this warden as a man trying to do his best. What really stunned me that day was the size of the prison cells. I don't remember the exact dimensions, but if you were to stand up now and take two steps forward, then go back to where you started and take two steps back and put your arms straight out at your sides. Go ahead and try that. Two forward, back to the starting point, two steps back. I mean, then you've got the idea. It was that small. I could not believe the state of New Jersey could do that to human beings, but they did. And that's a story for lots of states. You know, the public is so indifferent to how criminals are treated that there is no pressure on state or Washington authorities to treat criminals better than animals. And that's why we've got what we've got. Worse, state legislatures are even turning prisons over to private firms to operate. And they get paid per prisoner. They get paid for how many beds are full. So what's their incentive to let a prisoner out for good behavior? And meanwhile, the state legislatures, I know California for a fact, they're cutting back on every type of academic and training course that might help prisoners adjust to civilian life, including psychiatric services. So prisoners set free only commit more crimes and they're back behind bars. The result is USA, with 5% of the world's population, has 25% of its prisoners, 2.5 million people nearly behind bars. Hey, we must be some kind of terrible country to have all those prisoners, you think. But not exactly. It seems that a lot of the mental institutions got closed down, so the inmates got dumped into the prison system. And there are hundreds of thousands of mentally ill people in our prisons who belong in asylums. But does anybody care? Think back to when you heard a candidate for political office talk prison reform. Again, there are hundreds of thousands of our people behind bars for so-called crimes that would not be crimes in other countries, such as smoking pot. Now, there's a victimless crime, if ever there was one. Yet we go on punishing and punishing and punishing pot smokers. The answer to why has got to be because somebody is making a profit off of all those bodies behind bars. And at the same time, we are inflicting punishments on the prisoners far worse than anything they've done when they were walking around free. And that includes 60,000 rapes that are reported in our prisons every year, mostly young people. And, you know, it's probably more than that with all the unreported. So if you're out there listening, it's time for you to get involved in prison reform. Anyway, we've got a rapidly expanding practice of solitary confinement. I just saw on CNN today a man who was in solitary for 22 months. He just got an award for $15 million. And let me tell you, after what they did for them, the state got off cheap. This poem is called Against Solitary. What is there in all the devil's hell to rival the American prison cell? We're denied the sight of sun and stars. Prisoners live in a few square feet behind steel bars. 2 million inmates make us number one for locking up every last poor bum, like the ghetto youths who behind bars rot for the nonviolent defense of smoking pot, like those flung in solitary because they are mad and there are no asylum beds to be had. I was in prison and ye visited me, Jesus said. That was before solitary detention. Today, Jesus would be rendered brain dead denied human contact by deliberate inattention. Some prison wardens take great pains to punish inmates, literally by destroying their brains. Here there's no intention to make sick souls well. One warden called solitary a clean version of hell. Solitary makes even hardened criminals hallucinate, as isolation psychosis replaces reality. They see objects grow larger then smaller, then disappear in their totality. They see fiery phantasms fly through the air. They hear voices shriek that are not there. Buried away for months, for years, with none to record their screams and tears. No doctor can cure the insidious brain loss of crucified men on the invisible cross. Absent all contact with others, no human being these years can survive. Prisoners suffer feelings of suffocation, choking as men buried alive. If a nation be judged by its prisons, well may we fear God above, for the system of solitary sadism is the absolute antithesis of love. I'm Sherwood Ross. Good night to every one of you.
Thank you, Sherwood. A very moving poem. And as always, you're great. Have a good night.
You too.
No American should live in poverty, Barack Obama. Well, it's about time. We will do everything we can. We will raise the minimum wage to $9 per hour. No American should live in poverty. Hey, how about all the poor people go sit in Washington until that minimum wage gets jacked up to where people can actually live? That plan Martin Luther King had that got him killed. That would be imprudent, Barack Obama. We need to live in the real world. Make sure to pick up a copy of the rerun hit book and movie and reality show in your local Walmart, Hopeless, the Barack Obama story.
Tonight's Dick Tracy Crime Stoppers Bulletin. When you see something, say something. Because of the recent murder of 9/11 Truth author Philip Marshall and his family, a special bulletin has been released. Be on the lookout for FBI license plates in your neighborhood. When you see something, say something. Because of the murder of men, women, and children in Waco, Texas, be on the lookout for FBI license plates in your neighborhood. When you see something, say something. Because of the illegal torture, imprisonment, and false flag attacks designed to put the public in a state of panic in Guantanamo, Tucson, Aurora, Sandy Hook, and elsewhere around the country and globe, citizens are asked to be on the lookout for FBI license plates in your neighborhood, as well as a long black limousine with tiny American flags fluttering from the quarter panel. The persons inside the limousine are to be considered liars and murderers. This has been your weekly Dick Tracy Crime Stoppers Bulletin. When you see something, say something.
Your toilet is plugged and you know who did it, Al-Qaeda. You have a flat tire on the freeway. Yep, Al-fucking-Qaeda. You fall into a giant pothole as you turn off the freeway, disappear for days, and who did it? You got it, Al-Qaeda. Your burrito is undercooked and you get indigestion. There you go, Al-Qaeda strikes again. They are everywhere. Sleeper cells, caffeine cells, amoeba cells, Al-Qaeda, ninjas, ghosts, fairy tale characters. You've never seen them, but they are everywhere. This message brought to you by the Homeland, United States of America, Department of Homeland Security. Have a nice day. Well, it has been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown.
The attacks of 9/11 happened what should seem like a long time ago, but it does not. It seems like yesterday. There are people still locked away in Guantanamo, wars still being fought, people being killed, lies being told, new lies, old lies perpetuated and placed on monuments, all connecting in a straight line through the hearts of us all right to that day, that morning. September 11, 2001 happened everywhere, even in Mount Liberty, and now it can be told. At least something of how it affected the lives of the people there, what went on, the dirty details. Even though it seems not so long ago. The truth. The story of at least a few of the people who lived here during that time, enough time for someone to be born and grow to high school age, enough time for those in high school at the time to have children of their own, who don't have any reason to question, to ask questions, and so we could be quiet and let them be comfortable in not knowing. Could do that. Some of us still hear the news reports of those days, quotes we read somewhere, playing in our minds like there was a radio somewhere tuned to 12 years ago. You had to be there, as the saying goes, to understand what it was like. Kate Smith on the radio, George Bush on the TV, the towers coming down. There's a radio on somewhere. I hear it. Can't you hear that? We look. You have to look. You always look. Trust yourself. You know more than you think you do. Dr. Benjamin Spock. Last time we heard about Cooper Light, a young boy who had learned some things from his father and did not believe all he was being told on the radio, the TV, and in the newspapers. He was angry at the old people in the nursing home for having American flags on their doors as he delivered their morning papers, and he got hauled in to the principal's office in school for the message on his T-shirt, and he had to talk to the same guys in suits who sit outside his home all day long waiting for his dad to come home. He wasn't coming home. Well?
Spring bloomed with the joy of life to most, not all. To live in America and not encounter Americans would be damn difficult, he allowed. The postman, Pete Penny, grabbed handfuls of letters, slowly squeezing until they crumpled. With each bunch, he pictured good people gathered around Thanksgiving tables and 4th of July backyards. They're not good people. He clenched his jaw and bit his tongue without pausing. They only care about themselves. He touched his zipper to make sure it was up. He crushed a letter from somebody's pen pal in Des Moines, then scrambled to smooth it out on the table. Along one wall of the cavernous room stood 100 cases of It's What a Man's Got to Do selective service brochures, which Pete had tried to hide one afternoon by draping his rain poncho over the boxes. In a corner, a radio played Roy Orbison. Flush with the ceiling along the length of one wall, a full-color poster showed male and female postal workers smiling, staring at sample packages, depicting which type of packages were considered safe, which should be held suspicious. On the far wall hung an American flag that once flew over the Perkins restaurant at Disneyland, a gift from one of the carrier's customers who had moved to Florida. A hot tar smell drifted in from the city crew down the street. In the middle of the large room, below half a dozen twirling ceiling fans on low, Pete entered the second hour of his workday as the flying Walenda sun balanced on the telephone wires.
In front of him, the torn cover page of the February 21st, 1964 Life magazine, 25 cents, was taped to the wall of his workstation. Lee Harvey Oswald holding a Mannlicher Carcano 6.6 millimeter carbine. Next to the life page was a hand drawing in colored pencil. The yellowing paper curled at the corners showed a front yard that could have been in Mount Liberty on Pete's mail route. There was a white porch with a white cat sitting in the window. On the porch are two wicker chairs. Two bikes are in the yard, one upright with a kickstand down, one that sprawled on the sparse lawn. An American flag hangs limp from the corner porch post. Two glasses of lemonade sit on the steps, one empty and the other half full. A hand pushes against the screen door from the inside. Another hand reaches up with the cigarette lighter, setting the flag afire. The signature at the bottom of the page said Danny McGee, 1967. Pete Penny scratched his left calf with the edge of his right shoe. He sorted the mail for his route, firing each piece into a vertical slot on the large metal table in front of him. Flick, boom, flick, boom, flick, boom. The letters hit the back of the stalls like horses being jammed into the starting gate.
Pete watched his hands working as if they weren't his, grabbing from the large pile, flipping into the slots representing neighborhood blocks. He heard the anxious banter of the carriers building around him. He watched the nail of the pointer finger on his right hand dig into the tip of his nose and return to flipping. He had a gun right now. This is where the revolution would start, he thought. If things could just be the way they were supposed to be, he could just go do his route. Talk to the people in the sunshine, come on back home, click the gate closed on the picket fence on his way through, and sit down to watch the ball game surrounded by 10 children and his freshman sweetheart. That would be a life worth living. Shit, some people do that. Some people don't realize what stupid fucks they are. They're just happy. Stay stupid and happy, thought Pete. Then Danny McGee's face flashed on his brain screen for an instant. God damn them all.
Pete's right hand felt the length of his ponytail that itched between his shoulder blades before deigning to return to work. Two guys across the table talked about Iraq. Clean, shiny United States F-16s and B-52 knives spreading a sticky layer of blood and intestines over the sand. Pete felt his face flush. He took one step around the table, then one back again. He slammed open the rubber band door and stuck his fist inside one, spreading his fingers to fit the circle, retrieving the day's mail for Park to Jones to Philip to Fourth, and fitting the loop around twice. The tight bundle got tossed to the shine cement floor into a blue bag sporting a robo-eagle profile. Pete yanked the string on the bag pot, grabbed the one next to it, and threw them both over his shoulders. He stalked toward the big doors like Santa who had just about had it. Pete's long shadow raced him across the parking lot to his van. He unlocked the back, leaned down to tear off the annoying ragged corner of the Free Leonard Peltier bumper sticker, then snuffed up snot and watched his big feet walk around to the driver's door. After sucking in his paunch to snap his seatbelt, he checked his mustache in the mirror and turned on the swivel fan. "Just act normal," he said out loud. "You playing tonight?" Pete jumped when Jack France stuck his enormous head into the passenger side. "Oh." Pete reached for the pistol under the seat, then pulled his hand up and squeezed, patted steering wheel with both hands, threw his right arm over the passenger seat and leaned toward Jack with his answer. "Sure, what time?" 7:30, be there 7, bring your $4 for beer, don't forget. France's head made its exit, then his right index finger and thumb shot Pete between the eyes. "I will kill somebody before I play softball again," Pete vowed to the rearview mirror god. He turned to check behind, then backed out, rammed the van into gear, and took off.
Stomach rumbled. All his life, Pete had listened to people more than himself. Played softball, work here, drink this, shoot that. From Mount Liberty Elementary across the street from the postal shop to Vietnam across the damn ocean. He was tired of people. Always disappoint you. I'm not the man they think I am at home, he whispered out his open window. No, 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 I'm a rocket man. Then he stayed in second gear, puttering past the middle school, ancient, even when he'd passed through 100 years ago. Pete's stomach rubbed the steering wheel as he turned onto Phillip Avenue. He looked into the side mirror to adjust his wire rims and took his foot off the gas, his hands from the wheel. Postal buggies coasted to a stop in the middle of the street, 100 feet from the 4th Street intersection. Mrs. Rowe bent over with her head up her gladioli. Pete stared hard enough to tell she wasn't wearing other pants again. Sparrows and starlings darted from tree to tree with needles in their beaks as if waving clothes for Cinderella. The sound of the semis backing up to the sales barn muffled the 8th grade jazz band practicing A Hard Day's Night. Pete bit down hard on his molars and pulled the folded W-2 form from his front pocket. He remembered a lighter in the glove box, unsnapped the belt, and reached his full length for it. He remembered a hooch near Fan Long. This ought to burn. After testing the lighter, he held up the tax form and rested a corner in the flame. He watched the fire crawl toward his face. Ashes flicked out both open windows. Pete stared into the light. He pinched the far tip of the paper. The fire maneuvered to outflank his hot pointer and thumb. The edge of the orange bit him, and he flicked the wisp of curled paper into the street. U.S. government form. The ink and paper burned, shriveled, and went out.
Pete watched the little pile in his mirror as they headed off around the block in first gear to arrive on the south side of 4th. He parked, locked his door, walked to the back, and threw the strap over his shoulder. He fingered Mina Cobb's mail, something from Shaler, Pennsylvania, her sister, a Walmart flyer, the June Sports Illustrated. Mina was the great-great-granddaughter or something of Ty Cobb, as Pete had recently learned from a feature in the Mount Liberty paper. Pete dodged her flapping flag and heard baseball on ESPN through her open screen. He folded the magazine gently and dropped her pieces into the black box, then slowly closed the lid. Pete licked his burned fingers while walking across Mina's lawn. Hello. Jane Rowe looked around, like a veteran cow regarding a neophyte hitchhiker. Her head stuck out from behind her buttocks. A yellow ribbon was wrapped around a corner post of her porch with a neat, gigantic bow as if put there by the first-grade teacher of the year. He'd imagined such a bow wrapped around Jane's waist.
Hi, Mr. Speedy Delivery. She stood, put her hands on her hips, wiped her forehead like a tired cowhand. Sweat glistened on her arms like so much tanning lotion. A drip clung to her nose. She modeled jean shorts and a white tank top. Her blonde hair bounced in her ponytail even while she stood still. Pete and Jane turned their heads at the sound of Mina Cobb's air conditioner revving, looking like two whitetails in the meadow. He took a deep breath, sucked in his stomach. He felt the length of his mustache, poked at the crosspiece on his glasses. Beautiful morning, Jane testified. She turned to face him. She wasn't wearing a bra either, thought Pete. He never wears underwear, thought Jane. Interesting. What you got? She asked, taking a step toward him. Pete looked at the letter in his hand, saw his black coaching shoes and white socks pulled to his knees. He dragged the edge of the right shoe down his left calf, leaving the sock looking like it had just awakened. He handed over the letter. She looked at the return address, looked up for more. Singapore, Pete knew. Her husband worked for IBM. He was gone for months at a time. Oh, and this. He dug into his bag, pulled out a manila envelope from the Midwest Right to Life League. I've been waiting for this. She jammed the letter into her armpit, began to tear at the packet. Have a nice day, said Pete. A babe, even if she told on Danny. Yeah, you too. Jane Rowe walked up her steps, rifling leaflets and letters. She sat on the porch swing, rested her crossed legs on the railing. Pete stopped short of the sidewalk as a kid on a bike whooshed by. Hey, Coop, Pete yelled. Cooper roared along, pumping head down and up, his eyes on a goal 20 years down the walk. Cooper Light lived with his mother, Nancy, former wife Danny McGee, who'd achieved modest underground fame among the Mount Liberty disaffected, by hosting a radical left website called Liberty Bell. Danny left town months ago, headed for the East, after Mina Cobb or Jane Roe or maybe the teacher or the reverend had called the FBI. Pete was sure. Danny and Pete were best friends in high school. Defensive ends for the 71 district champs. After Vietnam, Pete hired on with the post office. Danny worked construction jobs. They both got married. Pete smoothed his ponytail, pushed his glasses on the middle piece, checked his zipper, then the right temple piece, then the left, right, left. Fucking shit, he said, swearing to quit the stupid habit. He dropped the group home mail, then his own, circled the block, picked up the bunch for the next section. 20 minutes later, moved the van another block for the next leg.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security Gestapo COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another New American Dream radio show. We thank you for joining us. We hope you'll be back again, same time, someplace, next week. I'd like to thank World News Trust for hosting our website, and James Boomy of June2508.com, who is sponsoring the show. And I'd like to thank my co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.